Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. I recently took Talking Paper to San Diego, California for an on-location episode on the topic of life experience. That includes writing about one's own life and the lives of others, keeping your knowledge and body healthy through research, and accepting the end of life. The first part of this episode, I interviewed Jim Ruland, who is a San Diego-based author and founder of the Vermin on the Mount reading series, which originated at the Mountain Bar in the Chinatown section of Los Angeles in 2004. Ruland previously worked as an in-house copywriter for a San Diego area Indian casino, using that five-year experience in the gaming industry as fodder for his debut novel, Forest of Fortune. Ruland later worked with Keith Morris, who was the original singer of punk band Black Flag, to create Morris's 2016 memoir, My Damage, the story of a punk rock survivor. I visited Ruland in the San Diego neighborhood of Barrio Logan, where he helps maintain an art, apparel, and jewelry store called Golondrina. We walked a few doors down to local coffee shop Por Vida, where I asked him to tell the story of Vermin on the Mount.
Vermin on the Mount. We're in our 13th year, if you can believe it or not. It started in Los Angeles when a friend of mine, Todd Taylor, who publishes Razor Cake fanzine, which was a fairly new enterprise at the time. It's been going on for 15 years, and I've been writing for that punk rock zine every one of those issues. And our friend Joe Mino from Chicago was coming out to LA, and Todd asked me to set up a reading for him. And I was like, well, instead of just doing a thing where it's our same handful of punk rock misfits and cretins, why don't we open it up a little bit and make it, you know, a kind of an eclectic thing where, you know, try to enlarge the tent a little bit. And he's like, sure, go for it. So we found a spot in Chinatown, and I invited a couple of different readers, Andrea Siegel, Josh Behrman, another Razor Cake writer named Mike Falloon from the East Coast, and Todd Taylor, he also read. And even before we started the first reading, the guy who was one of the owners of the Mountain Bar in Chinatown at the time was like, we got to do this again. And I was like, well, let's just slow it down. Let's see how it goes. But the place, Mountain Bar in Chinatown, unfortunately, is not there anymore. Mountain Bar, Chinatown's still there. But I was enamored with it because, you know, that was really important to the L.A. punk rock scene. You know, Madame Wong's and Hong Kong Cafe are all in those same buildings are still there. They've changed ownership and changed names, but all those is still very important to the scene. And now we were kind of sliding into it. So I like the idea of doing something that was kind of longstanding there, putting together, you know, LA's literary scene or pulling from the many scenes. And we had so much fun. We did it again, and we lasted in that spot for about 7 years.
It's amazing, the idea of finding these communities that pop up within large metropolis cities like Los Angeles, trying to find bastions of the arts there. What are the values of those kind of communities, in your estimation, for perpetuating the arts in cities like Los Angeles?
Well, I think like a reading series shares a lot of the same impulse that a fanzine does. You know, a fanzine being different from a culture magazine in that, you know, you write about the shit you're excited about. You write about the music that you love just so that you can get closer to it and have more access to it and understand it. And, you know, that was the reason why, you know, people started the music zines that I loved reading here in L.A. And it's still true today. Now, access is less important because in the digital age, everything is at your fingertips. You know, whether it's on iTunes or whether, you know, Bandcamp or people emailing, you know, tracks to each other, sharing tracks. But when it comes to a reading series, you know, people put together readers of literature they love.
It's also can be something that's mobile, something that's nomadic, so to speak. Tell me about the idea of a reading series like that being tethered to a place and how Vermin on the Mount left the Mountain Bar and how did it, if at all, evolve because of that move?
That's a great question. You know, it was really important that I keep it going in Chinatown because Chinatown was one of those weird places in the sense that even though it was definitely, if you look at a map of LA, it was, you know, it's in the eastern side of town. It wasn't Silver Lake or Echo Park. It wasn't Hollywood. It wasn't West Hollywood. It wasn't Santa Monica. It was kind of a place that, you know, for most people, they only went there, you know, as a tourist or when they brought their parents through. So it had like this kind of neutral vibe in terms of a scene. So it didn't have any of that like, oh God, I'm not going to go there because I'm never going to find parking or, you know, the West Siders, you know, because West Siders in L.A. have a bias against the East Side and vice versa. And it really just has to do with the hassle involved in parking and traveling and all that kind of stuff. So I think having it in Chinatown kind of eliminated some of that. It was a neutral site.
And speaking of neutral, it seems also, to a certain degree, at least for those who are reading there, I would assume culture neutral in terms of the people who are coming from their other cultural neighborhoods to read at the Mountain Bar in Chinatown.
That yes and no, because there's Chinatown is always, well, I shouldn't say always, but before I got in there, there was already art galleries and art spaces and, you know, art collectives doing things in some of those spaces there. So I don't want to make it sound like I just discovered or invented Chinatown or any of that, because that's certainly not true. But it was still a sense of discovery for a lot of writers. They're like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. It's a cool spot, a place off their usual cultural radar.
And speaking of culture, let's talk about the content of what was read there. It's, I would assume, a melting pot of all parts of Los Angeles, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And that was very important in the beginning and still important to me now. And that, you know, I didn't want it to be just a bunch of people reading, you know, new books of fiction. Even though that was and is my, you know, interest, short stories, novels, things like that. In the beginning, I think I was thinking like, well, I don't want, you know, a bunch of academics, you know, with elbow patches, you know, reading from books, you know, that already been published. You know, I wanted something that was more performative. When I first moved to LA in the early 90s, I was involved in the spoken word scene in Hollywood and in the San Fernando Valley, and hosted a reading series very briefly at a coffee shop on Lancashire Boulevard that I think now it's like a hot dog joint or something like that. That was more of an open mic kind of thing, and where everybody, you know, came in and did what they wanted to do. But it was right next to a recording studio, and Angelo of Fishbone discovered what we were doing, and he quickly figured out when the series was going on, and he would come in and basically take it over. And he would start his performance from before he even walked through the door. For a bunch of, you know, wannabe poets and writers, it was a really great instruction on how to be a performer. So that's what I've always kind of leaned toward, rather than the passive act of like reading from something that's already written, something that's more active, like here I'm going to share a story with you, which is way more dynamic. So I kind of gravitated more towards nonfiction and true stories, because over the years I learned that people pay attention when they know a story is true.
Is there a signature style to LA storytelling, poetry, compared to New York, now that you've read in both of those places?
Maybe I've heard more stories about the sex industry. That's certainly true. I know it's true of Vermin on the Mount. We've had a number of sex workers, male and female, share their stories. So I don't think there's a signature. What is universal for all the reading series in LA is support. It's not competitive. It's not, because we're so far removed from New York and all the deal making, it seems apart from that. So in New York, where the books are made and people are hyper aware of the who gets the deals and who doesn't and how those people are celebrated in that community, we're kind of ignorant of a lot of that stuff out on the West Coast. And so when there is success, everybody celebrates it across the entire culture. It's really kind of incredible.
And I have to assume that that carries over down to San Diego as well. Tell me about Vermin coming down here along with yourself. Is there any difference between the expression of the poetry community in Los Angeles versus San Diego?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to approach that question. But like for Vermin, I moved away from LA a couple years after I started it, but I kept the series going in Los Angeles. And then I only started it down here after 6 or 7 years. And when I did, it was only as one-offs because it was hard to find a venue. The venues that we had kept closing down. So I think if you're a poet in any large city, and San Diego is a large city, people tend to forget that it's like the seventh largest in the United States, that any urban city, you're going to be able to find a poetry night, an open mic night. If you're a poet, there's a place for you to go to share your work. That's not quite as true for prose writers and other forms of writer, people who, you know, want to write a monologue or a short story or a sketch or things like that. But San Diego does have a pretty thriving scene. You know, there's a couple of universities here. There are people doing really fantastic work in all kinds of genres. So there's a lot going on. I'm a huge fan of the literary organization So Say We All, and everything that they do for the literary community in San Diego, especially their show Vamp, which is a monthly show. I mean, the place is packed every time they throw one of those.
Jim, would you mind reading me some of your own work, maybe a short story?
Yeah, I'll read just a very quick excerpt from a zine that I've got here called Clown Detective. It really doesn't need a setup, but I'm going to give it anyway. It's about these two guys who are clowns and detectives. So they're working at a circus and they've got a dead body on their hands. One of the acrobats, an aerialist, has been murdered. Giovanni gathers flies in the hay. I've got all the animal handlers, tent jockeys, and the cooks from the kitchen assembled around the body. Anyone with access to knives, for obvious reasons. I want to know how Giovanni got into his present condition, whether it was a tiger tooth, butcher knife, or saw blade that did him in. Lacerations versus avulsions, serrated versus smooth. It takes a while because they can't agree on the nature of the wound that cut him in two. I watch them hash it out. I watch to see who's not hashing. Slim seems awful quiet. Maybe it's his nature. Maybe it's something else. Maybe he's latched on to the same conclusion that I have. The two halves don't match because it's two different people. Slim, I say, go get your sister.
Let's talk about the format you read that in. It seems like it's a classic zine, self-printed paper format. We're doing this interview in a lovely coffee shop that has such zines actually literally hanging from the ceiling. Let's talk about that format for a second. What do you like about the zine format and as an avenue for getting your work out?
DIY, do it yourself. I've always been drawn to that. That's part of the punk aesthetic that appeals to me most. I've been writing for punk rock zines all of my adult life. I came to them late. You know, I was not someone who grew up in zine culture in high school or anything like that. It wasn't until I got out of college that I started to meet people who were involved in that kind of thing and turned me on to, like, that you don't have to wait for somebody to say, to bless your manuscript and for you can put it out into the world. So while I'm putting together a short story collection, it's like, well, why wait? Trying to get a short story published is grueling these days. I mean, it's easier than it has been to get your work considered, because you just like pop it online and off it goes into the, you know, inboxes where it'll be carefully considered or ignored all over the United States and beyond. But with a zine, there's something really kind of gratifying about it. You print the story out. In this case, Clown Detective, I made a lino-cut illustration that riffs off the True Detective TV show. I actually made this like about a year ago. Yeah, it's got a nice lino-cut cover, and it looks gritty. Put it in someone's hands, they laugh, they thumb through it, and you feel good.
And when they turn to the back, there is, of course, Clown Detective number one. It says, features an original short story by Jim Ruland about two detectives who were clowns. It is not a work of fan fiction and bears no resemblance to the popular HBO detective series. And then there's your bio. And then there's the cover of your book, Forest of Fortune. Let's talk about Forest of Fortune. But before we get to that, because it does have some, very much so actually, autobiographical aspects in it, let's talk about your connection to San Diego. We're talking today in Barrio Logan. But that's not so far away from at least your professional entree to San Diego in the Navy. Let's pick up your story from there. And how did that eventually lead to the casino culture further inland?
Actually, it began before I was conceived. When my dad was in the Navy, he was sent to North Island for swift boat training prior to going to Vietnam, where he was the CEO of a swift boat. He did his training here, and he was from the Bronx. My mom was from Brooklyn, and they decided to move out to sunny Southern California while my dad did his training, because it was going to be fairly extensive. And then when my dad was in Vietnam, my mom would stay here, use her nursing degree. You know, then they'd be reunited when he returned. That all changed when my mom got pregnant with me, and my mom ended up moving back to New York so she could be with, you know, her family and things like that. When I joined the Navy when I was 18, I got stationed here in San Diego, California. And actually just about a mile or so from where we're standing right now is where I was stationed. I was actually in the Navy Reserves, but I had to do 2 years active duty because of the college program I was in. And when I was done with that and went back to go to college, I was like, done with San Diego. I'm like, I am not coming back here. It was a sailor town, and I was a sailor, and they were done with me. But now, one day in LA, I met my wife and she lured me down here. And what caused me to make the jump was I found a job on Craigslist, of all places, to being a copywriter in an Indian casino here in San Diego.
Let's talk about Forest of Fortune. What eventually led up to the publication for that? And what did it mean to you to, as a writer, to all of a sudden see that hardbound book of your work?
I knew that I had material for a book, even when I was at orientation at the casino, where they tell you about the history of a little bit of the Indian gaming, the history of the casino, the number of, the surveillance equipment that's around, so don't get any funny ideas, anecdotes about people who had unsuccessfully tried to rip the place off. I was like, I'm in heaven. This is so much great material there. So I was there just, like I said, a few days before I knew that I was going to work on something. I had been working unsuccessfully on a historical novel. I had shown it to my agent, and he invited me to explore other opportunities, which is code for getting, fired. I was like, I'm going to write a book about this casino. I'm tired of living in the past. I want to write about something that's right in front of my face, that I can walk the floor of the casino and stroll the aisles of the slot machines and just use that as my subject rather than all the research and diving into the abstract of history. And so I did that, and I was able to write the book fairly quickly, and then I revised it, and after about a period of a year I was able to get a new agent, and then after another year we were able to sell the book, and before it sold I was able to say adios to the casino. And that was one of the better days, I have to say, being able to leave a job I didn't like, or at least no longer liked, on my own terms, and be able to know that I had gotten something from the experience that was tangible. So I didn't feel like I'd wasted my time.
The classic place that people would think of going to casinos, Las Vegas, Atlantic City. In the Northeast now, you do have the Indian casinos of Mohegan Sun. What kind of casino culture does San Diego County have?
A very rich one, actually. San Diego County and Riverside County each have over a dozen casinos, which is quite a lot. So that's just 25 casinos just in Southern California, not including the ones north of L.A. and east of L.A. That's just the ones down south between Mexico border, before you get up into towards L.A. So there's quite a few. So it's very competitive. I imagine it's what it must be like working for a pizza franchise where you're in competition with everybody else and everybody knows it. However, it was kind of fascinating in that from the tribal point of view, is that even though that there is an awareness that, yes, they're competing for dollars, there's only a finite number of people that gamble and they have to choose their casino, they don't really aggressively campaign against one another, because in the larger sense, it's Indian gaming versus the world. And there's a million reasons why you can understand that mindset would be. They don't slam each other. When Verona Casino had adopted Kenny Rogers as their spokesperson, they set themselves up for a lot of negative advertising or, some pot shots. None of the casinos took them because they were never wanted to attack their brothers, their cousins, their kin. The tribal politics was really fascinating to me, and it remains fascinating to me. I mean, there are well over 550 casinos in the United States, Indian casinos, and each one of those represents a tribe, a distinct sovereign entity. Every one of those tribes has their own story to tell, and sometimes they use the casino to tell it, and sometimes they don't. All of those stories are really interesting to me.
Would you mind reading a passage from Forest of Fortune?
I guess I haven't really made it clear, but it's a suspense story, a little bit of the supernatural, it's got a little bit of crime. So what I'll do is I'll read the little epigraph from Lewis Carroll, and then I'll read the very short introduction. So this is from Lewis Carroll. "And as to being in a fright, allow me to remark that ghosts have just as good a right in every way to fear the light as men to fear the dark."
Ooh.
Here's a little italicized prologue. "You think you know luck? There are many kinds of luck, but those who come here to find fortune only think of the good. You can't imagine luck so bad it destroys you. You don't believe that such a thing is even possible. You think you are different. You think you are special. You wager what you cannot afford to lose. You do not consider the consequences of your actions, and then, before you know it, you are lost. It has always been this way. I once thought like you, but for many years I've spent here have taught me that fortune may favor the bold, but it abandons everyone in the end. You will see. I will take you to the other side of luck, the kind that is the opposite of chance. You will learn that luck doesn't matter when your fate has been sealed for centuries. Come with me, and I'll show you just how lucky you are.
Let's talk about your latest project with a fellow named Keith Morris. For those who don't know, who is Keith Morris?
Keith Morris is an icon of Southern California hardcore punk rock. He was the founding vocalist of Black Flag. When you think of the band Black Flag, you probably think, oh, Henry Rollins. Well, Henry, who has done a lot of amazing work with Black Flag, was the band's fourth vocalist. Keith was the first and was on the infamous Nervous Breakdown EP with, in my opinion, the very best Black Flag songs. And from there, Keith went on to form Circle Jerks and was just a punk rock party band of the 80s. His voice is very distinct even today. He's been through many things. He's 61 years old and he still performs in a hardcore band, a supergroup called Off.
How did you come to write a book with Keith?
We were like put together by a bunch of different people, but before I started Vermin on the Mount, I was involved in organizing a reading to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the British punk band The Damned, of their first show in LA, which was kind of like a hallmark moment in Southern California punk, because it was the first time that a British punk band came to LA, and it was a really galvanizing moment. There was already the beginnings of a scene, but after that it just exploded. So on the 30th anniversary of that, did an event with a bunch of punk rockers and old and new, and Keith was one of those guys. I think my long tenure with Razor Cake Fanzine, the 15 years, and fanzines that I wrote before that, I was just on the radar as a good person to team up with Keith when it came time for him to tell his story.
And this is, at least in the literary community, is a delicate art at times. Working with the person who's telling their story, can you summarize maybe some of the challenges that you maybe ran up against in terms of how to tell that story in, for lack of a better word, an honest way?
There really weren't that many challenges because Keith was into it. I've heard a lot of horror stories about rock stars who get the check and say thank you very much, and then they don't make themselves available to the writer, and then the pressure is on their collaborator to come up with something out of very little. That wasn't Keith. You know, Keith's not a rock star. He's a real guy, and he was really into it from the very beginning. So we spent countless hours together in his apartment in Los Feliz, you know, doing interviews, going over things, sharing photographs, you know, reminiscing about the past, you know, comparing, you know, different articles and interviews and getting the story and getting it right. And then once we had a manuscript, he was just as dedicated. I mean, he read through the manuscript no less than 3 times. The first pass, he caught things that the proofreaders had missed. You wouldn't think of Keith as, you know, hardcore editorial professional, but he certainly is.
Were there any passages in the book that you particularly like that you suppose came out of the interview relationship between you guys that might not have come out if, say, Keith had done this himself?
It was a dream gig for me because I was a fan of the music and a fan of the scene. You know, I got to ask questions about, not only did I get to ask about, you know, things like, well, what was it like being in Repo Man? How did that work? You know, that was probably the thing I most looked forward to talking to him about. But Keith and I, one of the things we did, we go on field trips. We drove down to his grandparents' house and the little house that his mom used to own. And in the back was the pink house, and in the back was the garage where they did their rehearsals. And we had the recordings going on, you know, while we were driving down there. And We went to Chinatown, we went to Hollywood, we went to different places where he had gigs, and memories would pop up. And I think those were some of my favorite stories. And also just seeing how people interacted with him, you know, because Keith is one of those guys that everybody recognizes right away. You know, he's like, he's not the biggest dude, but he's got these enormous long dreads. There's only one Keith Morris, you know?
And finally, on that note, is the story of Southern California punk rock being told to a satisfactory degree in your estimation? As you noted, Keith is 61. Some of these guys aren't around, are being around less. What's your take on it?
Absolutely. And I think we're going to see more and more stories. You know, this year was a kind of a banner year for rock and roll memoirs, and publishing company is going to take notice. And they're going to seek out some of the stories from some of the lesser known people, or people that maybe, I shouldn't say lesser known, but people in the mainstream community aren't quite as aware of, you know, or aren't aware of their connections to other communities and other punk rock scenes and cultures.
You've just gotten done collaborating with a singer on an autobiography. What's your favorite music autobiography? I'll start with telling you mine. White Line Fever, what's yours?
I'm a huge fan of a book that came out this year. It's also by DeCapo Press that put out My Damage, the memoir I collaborated with Keith. This is the NoFX story. It's called The Hepatitis Bathtub. And I was never a huge NoFX fan. I don't think I'm the demographic for it. And I've seen them. They're fun. You know, I've had a couple of their records. They're fun. But, man, that book is gnarly.
Tell me about Barrio Logan. Tell me about this street, and tell me about why you come here.
Okay, so I'm part of an arts collective called the Golondrina, and we have opened up a store here in Barrio Logan on Logan Avenue. We're just right down the street from it right now. It's me and my wife, another couple, and two other people, and we're all artists. We're all, you know, from, most of us live in Paradise Hills. Some from Chula Vista. None of us are from the actual Barrio Logan community, which I think is important to make that known, that we don't necessarily represent the community. We're just part of the amazing energy that's going on here. It's a really attractive place. There are, you know, there's new coffee shops and record stores and taco spots and breweries, galleries, you know, popping up all over the place, and some of them are having to shut their doors for a little while in light of what's happened with Ghost Ship. So I think the support is even more important now, because it's a reminder that, you know, one, we got to look out for each other always, and two, there's always going to be hurdles and always going to be obstacles, you know, for independent artists to overcome. And nobody can do it themselves. We have to do it together. So our little shop is a great example of that. You know, we've got, you know, art, apparel, jewelry. We've got my books and zines in there. We all take turns. We're only open on weekends, but we greet everybody, and we're getting to know the people in the community, and it's been an amazing experience.
For people in Brooklyn who come out to San Diego and are looking for readings to do, from your own personal experience, Jim, what are some good readings to hit up when they're in San Diego?
One of my favorite, as I mentioned earlier, is VAMP, which stands for Video, Audio, Music, Performance. I think it's mostly essays or like short, true stories. And it's a fascinating concept. What they do is they put out a theme and a call for stories. And so people send in their short essays, and the producers of the show will approve it. But it doesn't stop there. Then everyone who's approved gets together and they workshop their story. So they get to know each other, they help each other tighten the story up, and then each of the performers meets with a drama coach to kind of coach them up on the performance of the story. So by the time that you actually have the show, everyone is really coached up. Everybody knows each other. They're really pulling for each other. And plus, you've also got these elements where you can show video clips in the background, or photos, or photo montages, which is like a great way to get a laugh or to set a mood, and it makes it really fun.
Jim Ruland, thank you for being on Radio Free Brooklyn and talking paper.
Thank you.
You can see more about Jim's work at his website, jimruland.net, and follow him on Twitter at Jim Verman. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now Season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us to keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. For the second part of this episode, I interviewed Doctors Carla and John Fox, who are San Diego physicians specializing in internal medicine and geriatrics, pursuing those areas in private practice since 1979 and 1982, respectively. Among other positions, they have served as clinical professors of medicine at University of California San Diego Medical School, with Carla serving as an American College of Physicians California governor, and John serving as medical director of Vibra Hospital of San Diego. As they are now almost 40 years into their careers, I began my interview with them by asking Carla how she stays updated on the ever-evolving landscape of medicine within her practice.
Well, it evolves not just because the pace of your practice and your life changes, but because honestly, the technology has changed. So 40 years ago, when I began my residency, we all gained most of what we knew through pulling articles about things we were interested in. There was a lot of pressure to do that in residency and medical school. And then formal lectures, which we went to frequently in our training. We often had to organize and research lectures, and we read journals. As time went on and there was less time to do that, we would begin to read, and I still do, journals that actually summarize journals. So we'd have newsletters that summarized maybe the most important things happening in medicine. And more importantly, I have two medication journals that summarize the important things happening in new drugs and pharmacology. When I was an intern, there were three main antibiotics that we used. Now there are dozens that we use in the hospital. So with the explosion in the number of medications and the number of therapies and genetic medicine, which was almost nothing when we started, how do you get all that information and still run a practice? So we find that we go more often to formal lectures, and that's grand rounds, which are topics given by hospitals, maybe our hospital once a week. We go every year to the American College of Physicians 3-day meetings because their experts will summarize important consensus concepts that are derived from all the studies, the hundreds of studies that have been published that year that are relevant to us. It's no longer possible just to read journals and keep up with everything. There are just too many developments. So we tend to rely more on summaries, either summaries that we read or lectures that we go to or grand rounds now.
John, I'm going to shift back over to you for a second for a kind of a historical context point. You're a great reader of histories. Tell me about the early days of the way doctors used to gain knowledge through observation. You gave me a great example of the situation at Johns Hopkins University. What have you learned about that example?
Johns Hopkins University adopted a European style of training that was more rigorous, and it survived during a period of time when many of the medical schools in the United States were pretty sketchy, and about two-thirds of them were shut down after Abraham Flexner analyzed it. Was that 1915 or 1917, something like that? And so there were a lot of medical schools that really weren't doing very well from an academic standpoint, and the Hopkins Medical School and others were more rigorous and more academic. But I think even in their medical schools, is often done by anecdote or case study. Unusual case of this disease or that disease was reported. And organized clinical trials, the more formal type of clinical trials that we see today is something that's evolved, the double-blind case-controlled study. So we have very much higher standards for research nowadays than we did. I think this is once again something that has evolved since the early 1900s.
Comparing those early days to now, tell me about what you pick up through observation through your patients day to day. Are you still learning new things with each patient that you see?
Definitely. You start out with just formal medical school training, then residency training, which is both books, but now clinical bedside medicine. And when you get done, you know a lot. It's been very intense. But then comes the next decades where you actually gain experience. If something occurs 0.01% of the time or less, you have to see thousands of patients to see a few cases. So something new happens a lot. We rely on our judgment and our medical experience, but it surprises me how often I see things that I didn't recognize or hadn't seen before. And I learn that I will send the patient to a consultant who will tell me what's going on, or the patient themselves will explain something to me that I really haven't seen before. And it just goes into my memory bank and it becomes part of what I know. But you think it's going to end after your training, and it just goes on and on. A lot of what I know, I've learned from just seeing patients.
And let's take up on that training. This marks, I believe, the 40th anniversary of your graduation from medical school.
Right.
Can you compare, at least in broad strokes, the landscape that you entered 40 years ago? Maybe specifically, we can start with the types of diseases that might have been prevalent that you were seeing in the early days, but maybe not so much anymore.
We thought it was the end of really conquering infectious disease because we had a vaccination for polio, which killed people when I was growing up. We knew an awful lot about infectious diseases, and we had good antibiotics. We never were prepared for the explosion of new diseases never before described, like HIV/AIDS, like Legionnaire's disease, like hantavirus, and I can name a lot more. There are even new kinds of infectious hepatitis that we'd never heard of before. And the emerging resistance of antibiotics to diseases we knew about has also happened. So it changed enormously the way medicine was practiced. It increased the expense enormously. When I was first came out into practice, we didn't have CAT scans. They were just emerging. We didn't have MRIs. We had X-rays. So those things were not cheap, but they were nothing like the cost of all the newer imaging and therapies. So lots and lots has changed.
John, a few years later, 1979, I believe. What's the difference in the landscape? Same question.
We have better diagnostic tools. It's really interesting to reflect on how the treatment has changed. When I started my internship, some of the older doctors in the hospital were giving blood thinners for someone who'd had a heart attack. And we thought that was insane and that that had gone out 15 years before. And we laughed at the older doctors, but it has evolved over the next 20, 25 years. So it's absolutely standard therapy to give blood thinners once again. And there are other examples I could think of where treatments that were questionable have gained currency because further research has found that they work. And other treatments have been abandoned, of course. So it is really a moving target. I think the challenge for us as more senior physicians is not to get left behind.
Specifically, the types of patients that you treat have special needs. At this point in your careers, tell me about the geriatrics side of your practice. And what are some of the unique aspects of treating that area of patient?
So geriatrics. One of my mentors and a respected colleague said some 20 years ago that he thought geriatrics wasn't a separate discipline, that it was so integral to taking care of patients in general that it shouldn't have a separate designation. This is the opinion of a very sophisticated doctor. He has changed his tune. Because I think as we learn more about geriatrics, we realize that the older patients really have to be handled differently. They process the medications differently. They have either more side effects. You might have to reduce the dosing or use different drugs. And so the discipline of geriatrics has come into the mainstream and then has evolved where it's clearly a separate entity that has a lot of its own aspects. And I would say aside from the demographic piece, you've got the way that elder folks respond to medicine differently, and then you've got all the issues for end-of-life issues and how to balance off your priorities in an older patient who's failing in one way or another, and some things you can fix and some things you can't. So,
moving back over to Carla, tell me about your own thoughts about caring for patients in this age demographic.
Well, since we've been in practice so long, a lot of our patients were young when we were young, and they've actually evolved with us, so you get a longitudinal study of what it's like. We used to worry about pap smears and things that younger people got. Now we're looking at there are more cancers with these people. There's more cognitive loss. It's hard to imagine someone who is vital and working and with it, and you watch into their 70s and later, and they begin to really lose their cognition and kind of lose their personhood. I, of course, see people I haven't followed for decades, but you really get a sense of what evolves. My own experience as a geriatrician in looking at senescence, that is the degradation of tissue and the degradation of human beings, whether it's loss of bone density, loss of muscle mass, the things that lead to frailty, is that if I had to pick one thing that we have to do something about, it's memory loss. Even if your heart fails, it fails. We're getting to be pretty good at that. But nothing destroys your quality of life and the quality of life of your family like cognitive loss. And we really need to be putting more research effort into that, because we really haven't gotten very far with treatment. And the truth is, the NIH is putting more money into it. And we really need to, because all of us are prone to this.
You're listening to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. Something that's very popular among people in my age group, my friends, is consulting WebMD before they approach their doctor. You mentioned when it comes to cognitive stuff, one of the cruel parts about the degenerative nature of that is that you sometimes don't realize when it's happening. There's no real obvious signs of it. Dealing with patients in your demographic, do you see them taking advantage of self-research, pursuing stuff before they come to you, whether it's online stuff, whether it's medical journals, medical books? Has that been something that you've noticed among any of your patients?
More and more, I do see patients researching things. They come in with ideas. Their researching is better. The younger people are, the more facile they are about researching things. Learning how to identify good data from bad, it involves more training and understanding scientific method. And how do you identify reliable data and separate it from unreliable data? That's what we think is important for patients. But many people do that. People who are losing their memories often aren't as facile in looking up data. They're often older. Their families may have looked it up. They are sort of a separate group. They're often in denial. Usually or often they come in with family members, friends who are worried about them. And more often, they themselves haven't done much research on that topic, although people will do research on other ailments they might have.
Let's talk about end-of-life family members who are doing their own research. This seems like something that you deal with day-to-day. How prevalent is that?
Well, first, as far as families and patients doing their own research, it's very interesting. In my training, in my earlier days, I dealt with a demographic of people who were less sophisticated, didn't read as much, honestly didn't necessarily even follow my advice very well. And as my practice evolved, I got to a different demographic, people possibly more affluent or more in touch with resources such as the internet. So now I've got patients who go to the other extreme who are digging into all the internet and other resources like WebMD, let's say, and come in with a lot of information. The challenge is to sift through that, either for me to sift through it or for them to sift through it and understand what is reliable information, what is just unreliable. And that's very challenging. I wish that we all were better educated in how to sift out the wheat from the chaff. you get into an end-of-life situation or a hopeless situation, and I'm trying to guide the family and the patient through reality testing, like what is a goal that's reasonable, what's unrealistic. And sometimes this outside information can be a distraction even. A treatment that isn't really a viable treatment comes into center stage. I had a patient today with a spinal cord injury, and family rushed up to me because they said, I'm not giving the patient enough vitamin D. Well, vitamin D is a very interesting vitamin, but I don't think it's going to help the spinal cord patient. But there's some information out there, and you just have to decide whether it's reasonable information or not. In my end-of-life patients, it's a huge project because it's not just taking care of the patient, but taking care of the whole context of the family and their expectations and planning. And it's a process that very often is a downhill kind of a thing. You know, the patient's going to not survive the illness, but you have to, it's a glide path, if you will, and you've got to guide the patient down a path that is comfortable and reasonable, and you have to work with the family to align their expectations with reality. And in that context, the outside information, the internet information, is a mixed bag. I mean, I encourage people to read about stuff and become educated, but I find it challenging to integrate that information into what I'm trying to do.
Let's talk about now shifting from private practice to having a chance to really reach a wider group of people or even have an impact on other doctors and patients and perceptions and whatnot. Carla, you recently served a relatively high-profile state office here in California. Tell me about your tenure there. What were some of the things that were your goals while you were serving in that capacity?
So I think all of the specialties have their own colleges or academies. And what that really means is it's an academic organization. So there's an American College of Surgery, there's an American College of Physicians, which I was a governor of, and in this case, physicians means internal medicine specialists. There's an American Academy of Pediatrics and so forth. All of them have national organizations that are divided into regions or into state organizations. And what they do is they have advocacy arms that lobby for important developments or laws. We worked hard for the Affordable Care Act. We felt it was very important to expand access to medical care that was affordable for patients nationwide. 46 million people in America did not have health insurance, and many millions more couldn't get adequate health insurance. So that's one example of medical advocacy. And I still, even though I'm not the governor, I lobby in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. with my organization every year. We also arrange for educational presentations, both at the national and state and regional level, to keep our members educated. So we try to be relevant because people have to pay us to be in our organization. Most of us oversee preparation for the testing that is given in order to get board certification in a specialty. The American Board of Internal Medicine administers the test, but the American College of Physicians, Surgeons, and what have you actually helps publish materials and give programs to prepare our members to pass those tests. Otherwise, they can't really claim to be board-certified specialists. So we try to do these things, try to keep people at a very high level of practice and ethics. And all these groups weigh in on what they consider to be ethical practice as well.
So for Christmas this year, you very kindly gave me this biography or autobiography of Oliver Sacks, On the Move, A Life. Let's talk about the idea of the doctor as a public person. Sacks is obviously a very interesting guy. He's written multiple books, and for a show called Talking Paper, he's a perfect candidate for having an opinion on. What do you know of Sacks? What's your take on someone in the medical profession having that kind of profile, and what's your opinion of the effect that that can have on perceptions of the medical profession?
Well, Oliver Sacks, first of all, is a very interesting human being, and his life story makes the point that physicians are human beings and they have many different facets. He certainly did between his professional activities and then his non-professional activities such as weightlifting and motorcycle riding and whatever. So that's, I think, an important point. And he's a very colorful individual. And I think all doctors have to be viewed through not just the eye of their professional lives, but their lives outside their profession. The other thing that I think is so interesting about Oliver Sacks is his skills as an observer of patients. And he's a good writer, but his descriptions of just what he saw with these various degenerative neurological diseases, such as Parkinson's, I think so much of medicine is the ability to observe a patient and interpret what you're seeing. Using Parkinson's disease as an example, there's no way to diagnose it except to watch how the patient moves. And you can diagnose Parkinson's disease across the living room or the parlor because you look at the person. I've seen people on TV giving a speech and realize that they have Parkinson's disease. And Dr. Sacks more or less made those kinds of observations and had the great talent to be able to write them down and relay them. So
let's stick on that for a moment, because very famously there's the example of his work Awakenings, which was turned into a Harold Pinter play, and then even more famously, a movie about a circumstance of this observation of Parkinson's and what, spoilers, proved to be a false hope. Can you summarize that example of observational medicine and what was entailed with that?
When it was recognized that Parkinson's disease was caused by a deficiency of a chemical in the brain called dopamine, science was able to provide pills that had dopamine in them, and it basically found its way into the brain and helped relieve the symptoms of Parkinson's. And of course, the problem with this is that the body learned to break down the dopamine chemical, and so you had to keep giving higher and higher doses to have something get through to the brain to fix the problem. And so you, or in the early days, before that problem was solved, you would get people that have a wonderful response to the medication, only to either that they'd run out of enough medicine to, they couldn't manufacture it fast enough because the doses had to be higher and higher. So finally, the patients would return to their pre-treatment state, just as impaired as they ever were. So it was sort of a glimmer of hope. It was eventually solved to the extent it could be by having an inhibitor to the enzymes that broke down the dopamine chemical and combining that in a combination type pill.
Films and books, whether through Oliver Sacks' writings or other doctors who pursue this, there's even a show on morning television now called The Doctors. There are all kinds of areas where medicine breaks through into pop culture, shall we say. Depictions of it in movies, depictions of it in books. There's a show called The Nick, which has really showcased the early days of medicine and what doctors were up against. The only possible downside I could possibly see is that a lot of them are for entertainment purposes.
Marcus Welby, I mean, a TV show where the whole focus was on the gentle, kind doctor making house calls. And that's fine to an extent, focusing on the personality of the doctor. But I think it has its limitations. Where I see there's a need to make a bridge to the public is to understand the struggle that the medical profession goes through trying to settle on the right diagnosis and navigate their way in an uncertain area as far as treatment, and to communicate to the public an understanding of the process so that in the end of the day, the public would have a better understanding of what kind of expectations they can have of the medical process, and not these cardboard cutouts. I think in one sense, the extremes of the benign Marcus Welby doctor or the trauma surgeon in a war zone or something are cardboard cutouts. It's the bread and butter day-to-day struggle to do the right thing. And I think if the public got a better understanding of that, they'd be in a better position to understand what their personal physicians trying to do, let's say in the context of the end of life care where we have false hopes and expectations, things that can't be met or beyond the reach of medicine. So that's where I think possibly the creative aspect or the communication aspect of whether it's a print or movie or whatever venue would help.
You both read for pleasure when you're not on the job. And I am curious, this is a show called Talking Paper. Tell me about a book that you've enjoyed that you've read recently and tell me why.
I read a book called Hillbilly Elegy by a relatively young man who grew up in Appalachia and is trying to explain why his demographic and where he comes from thinks the way they do, and why politicians, policymakers, sociologists don't really understand them. And what we do is a lot about understanding what motivates people, what culturally affects them, because it has everything to do with getting them to understand and accept appropriate treatment. Because I can know everything. In 5 minutes, I know your blood pressure has to be treated. I know what will happen at this level if you don't. And that goes for a lot of things. But the next 6 months is spent figuring out how to connect to you and make you think it's important too. So I find these sort of studies of real human beings and what they do, especially if they're amusingly or well-written, I just think it's fascinating.
Well said. John?
I think I'm more of an escapist. I love reading nonfiction, and my most recent read in that category is about the Barbary pirates in Tripoli. Just loved seeing how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and some of the others put together our foreign policy in the early 1800s. So.
And it's worth noting one other thing about reading histories, and especially with the Navy. You came to medicine from the Navy. Do you find yourself drawn to naval stories or medical stories or things that you have been an active part of professionally? Mm-hmm. Or as an escapist reader, do you find yourself drifting away from those?
You know, I read pretty broadly. I certainly enjoyed reading sea stories, whether it's Captain Hornblower or reading about Horatio Nelson, and a lot of sailing stories, I have to say, I enjoy reading that. But I enjoy history, especially going in phases, but I like early American history. And I love reading about Theodore Roosevelt and other historical figures. So I have to say, I just read all over the place. And I don't see myself just following threads of my day-to-day experience so much.
And may we all have a more broad approach to exploring the world in such a way beyond just what we do for a living. John and Carla Fox, thank you both for being on Talking Paper. To find out more about the doctors, visit their website at johnandcarlafoxmd.com. Now, the lyrics to Nervous Breakdown by the band Black Flag from their 1979 debut EP. I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. My head really hurts. If I don't find a way out of here, I'm gonna go berserk. 'Cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders. It's going berserk. I hear the same old talk, talk, talk. The same old lines. Don't do me that today. Yeah, if you know what's good for you, you'll get out of my way. 'Cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders. Going berserk. I won't apologize for acting out of line. You see the way I am. You leave any time you can, 'cause I'm crazy and I'm hurt. Head on my shoulders. Going berserk. Crazy, 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 crazy. I don't care what you fucking do. I don't care what you fucking say. I'm so sick of everything. I just want to die. Finally, here's an excerpt from the memoir On the Move by Oliver Sacks, within the chapter where he describes the response to the publication of his book, Awakenings. I could not, of course, have written Awakenings without the encouragement and permission of the patients themselves, who had an overwhelming feeling of having been disposed of by society, put away, forgotten, and wanted their stories to be told. Nonetheless, I was hesitant, after the episode with the Daily News, to publish Awakenings in the United States. But one of my patients somehow got wind of the English publication and wrote to Colin, who sent her a copy of Awakenings, and then it was out. Unlike Migraine, which had earned good opinions from both general reviewers and medical reviewers, the publication of Awakenings was greeted in a puzzling way. It was very well reviewed in the press generally. Indeed, it was awarded the 1974 Hawthornden Prize, a venerable award for, quote, imaginative literature. I was thrilled by this, as I joined a list including Robert Graves and Graham Greene, among others, to say nothing of James Hilton for Lost Horizon, a book I adored as a boy. But there was not a murmur from my medical colleagues. No medical journals reviewed it. Finally, in January of 1974, the editor of a rather briefly lived journal called the British Clinical Journal wrote that he thought that two of the strangest phenomena in England in the preceding year had been the publication of Awakenings
and the complete lack of medical response to it, what he called the, quote, strange mutism of the profession. Nonetheless, the book was voted Book of the Year by five eminent writers, and in December of 1973, Colin threw a combined publication and Christmas party. There were many people at the party I had heard of and admired, but had never met or thought to meet. My father, who was just recovering from a year of mourning for my mother, came to the party, and he, who had been so anxious about my publishing, saw all sorts of eminent people there and was greatly reassured. I myself, who had felt so lost, so unknown, now felt rather lionized and feted. Jonathan Miller was at the party too, and said to me, quote, "You're famous now." I didn't really know what that meant. No one had ever said anything like this to me before. That's all for this West Coast episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.